Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Jonathan Weber, West Coast Bureau Chief of Reuters News, and your moderator for the program. Today's program is part of the club's series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. And now it's time to introduce today's speaker, Grover Norquist, founder of Americans for Tax Reform and conservative activist. There's little question that Grover Norquist is one of the prime movers behind conservative policy in the 21st century. As the controversial president of Americans for Tax Reform, founded at the request of President Ronald Reagan in 1985, Mr. Norquist works to limit the size of government and oppose higher taxes at the federal, state, and local levels. He's perhaps best known for the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, which asks candidates for federal and state office to commit themselves in writing to oppose all tax increases. In the 113th Congress, 219 House members and 39 senators have taken the pledge. Mr. Norquist also currently serves as a contributing editor to the American Spectator magazine. He's on the board of the National Rifle Association and president of the American Society of Competitiveness. He previously served as economist and chief speechwriter for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Norquist holds an MBA and bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard University, and his theme today will be the Modern Republican Party and the Future of America. Please welcome Grover Norquist.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you to the Charles Travers family for this opportunity. Delighted to be out here with wonderful weather. I want to talk about the modern Republican Party and the future of the country. And in doing so, let me back up a little bit on the Republican and Democratic parties. In the United States, we have two parties for historical reasons and also because we passed laws that made it tougher for third parties to exist. But in a lot of countries around the world, Europe and other places, if you got 3% of the vote, you might decide who the prime minister was, and you would be terribly important. But in the United States, if you started a party and got 3% of the vote, you'd be officially a nut. And you wouldn't get to fly in Air Force One. You might get a radio talk show at the end of the campaign, but you don't get to win. And so in the United States, if you care deeply about something, whatever that issue is, you probably pick one of the two parties, and both the parties, therefore, are themselves coalitions of various positions that people have taken over time. So if you've got 3% of the electorate, you join one of the two teams to get it over the finish line. And though for 100 years or so, the two political parties were really regional parties. If somebody told you they were Republican, all you really knew about that person was that they were born north of the Mason-Dixon line. You didn't know their positions on taxes or spending or foreign policy. And as a result, there are all these little old ladies in Mississippi who agreed with Ronald Reagan on absolutely everything and voted for George McGovern because Sherman had been unpleasant to Atlanta recently. Which is not necessarily how you want to pick up teams if you're trying to govern the most powerful, wealthiest, important nation in the world. But it was how we did it for quite some time. It was during the lifetime of Ronald Reagan, the political lifetime of Ronald Reagan, that the two parties actually sort of sorted themselves out in what I think we all see as a much more rational way to do it. If you want more limited, restricted government, you're a Republican. If you have a more expansive view of what government can do for and to you, then you're a Democrat. And the two parties have sorted themselves out. And that shows up in the project that I do, Americans for Tax Reform, is nonpartisan. We ask all candidates, Republicans and Democrats, to make a written commitment to the voters of their state that if elected, they won't raise their taxes. No net tax increase. Tax reform, yes. So we designed the Taxpayer Protection Pledge to help enact the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which was dropping rates, broadening the base, revenue neutral. The point of the pledge was both in that tax reform and in the series of reforms that we hoped would come, that the term tax reform would never become a Trojan horse for higher taxes. That when you promise tax reform, meaning simpler, fewer deductions and credits, lower, less distortive tax policies, that's what you'd get, not that's what they'd say, and then when they came out of the room, it was a tax increase. So we got 20 senators, about 100 congressmen at that point who signed the pledge, said, look, we're not raising taxes, not now and in the future. Tax reform, yes. Tax increases, no. And then that moved forward over time to the point where more than 90% of the Republicans in the House and Senate, and even more than that in terms of candidates running in primaries, make that commitment in writing to voters. And very few Democrats make the commitment at the national level or even at the state level. We tend to get Democrats shortly before they lose the next election or switch parties. So we do get some, but they tend not to stay Democrats terribly long. And that's because the two parties, and again, we ask everybody the same number of times, but if you're of a certain age and you've become a Democrat, you're not going to commit not to raise taxes because you have a different view of government, which is always open to higher taxes, and the Republicans see it the other way. So we have the two parties that have sorted themselves out along those lines. And in talking about the future of the Republican Party, let me walk through with you what the modern Republican Party's become and how it's structured, give you some idea of what it will do in the future, what it won't do in the future, and the Democratic Party that contends with for power at the federal and state level, how the two of them have interacted and will. In Washington, D.C., we have a meeting every Wednesday in our offices at ATR, about room about this size, 150 people, big circle. 30 people present for 3 minutes each about what they're doing and what they're up to. It's around a big table, and the point is you want to make sure that the broad center-right knows what everybody else is doing. So around the it's nonpartisan, but most of the people are Republicans, conservatives, libertarians, the Reagan Republican conservative movement. Around the table, who's there among the modern Republican Party? If you're trying to figure out what the Republicans will and won't do. Taxpayers, don't raise my taxes. Property owners, don't violate my property rights. Everybody, as we go around the table, you'll notice everybody's there because on the issue that moves their vote, not necessarily all issues, but the issue that moves their vote, what they want from the government is to be left alone. Taxpayers, leave my income alone. Businessmen and women, don't tax or regulate my professional life out of existence. The Second Amendment community, I serve on the board of the National Rifle Association, leave Second Amendment rights alone. You don't see those gun owners knocking on your door on Saturday arguing that you should become a hunter, or insisting that every fourth grade child read books in public school entitled Heather Has Two Hunters. They just wish to be left alone with their Second Amendment rights. Around the table, all the various communities of faith, people who, for the most important thing in their life is practicing their faith, transmitting it to their kids, they simply wish to be left alone to do that. Evangelical Protestants, conservative Catholics, Orthodox Jews, Muslims, Mormons, they don't agree who gets to heaven or why or how, but they do agree they should be left alone so they can go to heaven, and all those other guys around the table who completely misunderstand Scripture can go straight to Hades on their own, but that's the cost of me being able to get it right. But what they want is to be left alone in their own zone. So you go around the homeschooler movement, the people concerned about school choice, people who want more control over their own education for their own children. So around the table, everybody's in on their vote-moving issue. And what's important to understand, if you're trying to manage the Republican Party or argue with it or inform it, understand why they're there in the first place, all the various groups. You can get people talking about any number of issues. We saw this with Pat Buchanan running for president. He wanted to talk about, he said, polling data shows 70% of Republican voters think there's too much free trade with China. 70% of Republican voters think there are too many immigrants. Okay. Okay, and he got 1% of the vote. Now, he forgot to ask the second question. Having told me politely what your position was on those issues, because I asked, I forgot to ask the second question. And do you care? Do you care enough to vote on that issue? You may talk about it. Talk radio shows have talked at great length about some of these issues. But do you vote on that issue? And this is where politicians get in trouble all the time. They hear people talk about an issue. They look at polling data and they say, see, everybody agrees on that issue. I will take that position and therefore I will win. And you've got to, there are a couple of issues. One is, do you believe that if I run for mayor, I have any say on the subject that you just brought up? Okay. Or if I run for president. And two, is that the issue you vote on or do you vote on a different issue? It also allows you to work with your coalition. The modern Republican Party, when we looked at its coalition, a lot of the, if you polled the religious right, evangelical Protestants, they would tell you they were for prayer in school. And so the Republicans put several years, they put up, let's have a prayer in school constitutional amendment, because the court had said you can't have it without an amendment. And, 90%, of the people in the country would say they're for it, and you'd lose votes on it because 3 to 5% religious dissenters, religious minorities were very strongly against it and worried about what the prayer would look like, and all the guys who told you they were for it didn't vote on the subject. So how do you lose with, my pollster tells me it's a 90% issue. I walk out, 90% of the people go in them, looks fine, 5% of the people in them go, uh-uh, and the only guys who remember on election day what you said were the five. Turn that around. What happened? That impetus became the school choice movement. So you went to the same people and said, how would you like the ability to decide where to send your kid to school for academic reasons or for questions of religious schools? And then all of a sudden, religious dissenters go, hey, I'm in. I'd like that because I'm a religious minority, and that would protect me and give me more control over helping my kid's education. So instead of dividing folks against you, it actually was part of outreach. And the people who said they wanted prayer in school were actually just sort of commenting on they'd like more values in their school, but school choice would give you that too. So you can take an issue that appears to divide your coalition or divide you from others and turn it into more unifying if you understand why people in your coalition are there. So it also explains why in the modern Republican Party we keep having these predictions of coming splits. I remember 1980 campaign, Reagan was running for president, and the New York Times said, some of the people voting for him have jobs. Some go to church. They'll be at each other's throats any moment. And I remember thinking, why would they be at each other's throats? Because as we manage the meeting in D.C., and there are 47 states have similar meetings in and around the modern conservative movement, the Republican Party, the guy who wants to make money all day looks across the table at the guy who wants to go to church all day and says, that's not how I spend my time, but that doesn't get in my way. And they both look over at the guy who wants to fondle his guns all day and say, well, that's not how we spend our time, but okay. And so they're not in conflict on a vote-moving issue. It's not to say they all have tea together. It's not to say they live in the same neighborhood. It's not to say they watch the same movies. They don't have to agree on some 20-point plan. You just need the candidate to stand in the middle of the room and say, I'm going to leave your kids alone, your faith alone, your money alone, your business alone, your property alone, and then let's go do stuff. And so that's what's allowed the center-right coalition, the Reagan-Republican coalition, to hold together. People look and see fractures, and they need to ask, are these fractures on vote-moving issues? And I would argue that the fact that it's been hanging around for 30 years and getting stronger, not falling apart, is a piece of that. Can a candidate misunderstand why somebody's in the room and speak to them on secondary and tertiary issues, which they understand but which frighten, irritate, or chase away others? Yes, you can, and we've seen people do that. But that's why it's important that candidates understand why everybody's in the room. I got a call when Hillary Clinton was running for Senate in 2000 from a New York reporter. And the New York reporter said, well, Hillary Clinton was just up in New York, and she said what progressives need is one of those meetings like Grover has where we get everybody together. What do you think of that, says the reporter. And I walked through how our coalition worked, and I said how I think Hillary's coalition, the left's progressive coalition, would have more challenges. And every once in a while they announce in D.C. they're going to put one of these meetings together. And the challenge is who's around the table, the modern Democrat Party, around the table. Trial lawyers, labor union leaders, big city political machines, two wings of the dependency movement, people locked into welfare dependency, guys who make $90,000 a year, managing the dependency of others, making sure they don't get jobs, become Republicans. Then you have all the coercive utopians, people who get government grants to enlighten their moral inferiors on how they should structure their life. These are the people who mandate that cars are too small to put your entire family into, who come up and mandate the toilets that don't flush completely. And on the Sabbath, you have to separate the green glass from the brown glass from the white glass for the recycling priests. And they have a list of things that you have to do or you're not allowed to do that's slightly longer and more tedious than Leviticus. Anyway, it goes on and on and on. Now, the left's coalition can work together as long as we keep putting more money in the center of the table. Okay? And then everybody can get along cheerfully like they do in the movie shortly after the bank robbery. One for you, one for you, one for you. Everybody around the tables, happy and cheerful. But if the pile of money in the center of the table begins to dwindle, then all the guys around the table begin to look at each other a little bit more like the second of the last scene in the Lifeboat movies. Okay? Now we're trying to decide who we eat or who we throw overboard. And so, which explains, okay, how does the Republican Party act? How does the Democratic Party act? First thing the modern Republican Party says is stop throwing money in the center of the table. Okay? Stop hiring more Democratic precinct workers. And so, one, no tax increases. And there's a political reason, don't do tax increases. The other team hires Democratic precinct workers with it. Two, the other is, until you say no to tax increases, you never reform government. Okay? There's always the second half. A lot of people focus on don't raise taxes. Fine. Good. If you get that one right, that's a very helpful step. There's a second step. Reform government so that it's more effective and costs less. But you cannot and will not ever have the second conversation until the first conversation is closed. We're not raising taxes, end of conversation. Now. Now we're going to reform government. Because if the doors open to tax increases, whatever you start to do, reform of government, thinking about doing things differently, asking whether something you've been doing for 50 or 20 or 100 years still makes sense, well, we'll just raise taxes, keep doing everything we've been doing, and you had that new idea, Fred, we'll do your new idea. We'll just get more money and do the new idea too, also. We'll put new barnacles right on top of all the old barnacles, and we'll just keep going. So step one, don't raise taxes. Step two, you can get to reform in government. And I would argue we just lived through the third big fight on this subject, 1982. Democrats went to Ronald Reagan and said, if you raise taxes $1, it's actually $82 billion, but for each dollar of taxes you raise, we will cut spending $3. And since Democrats had the House and Republicans who thought like Democrats were running the Senate, and Reagan was kind of outnumbered, he agreed to this 3-to-1 deal and evidently believed it was actually going to happen. And taxes went up and spending didn't go down, spending went up. Okay. You didn't get $3 of cuts, you didn't get $2 of cuts, you didn't get $1 of cuts, you didn't get any cuts. Spending went up because they took all the money and they spent more. Then 8 years later, they went to George Herbert Walker Bush, who'd not been paying attention, and they said, here's our deal. You give us $1 of tax increase, we'll give you $2 of spending cuts. Now, I thought that was just insulting. Seems to me if you're going to cheat somebody, we'll give you $10 of imaginary spending cuts. Instead, they said, you are a cheaper date than the last guy, and you get $2 of imaginary spending cuts. Anyway, he took the deal. Taxes went up. Spending went up more than it was planned to do. And it didn't go down less than we were promised. It went up from where it was before. Taxes went up, not down. Having lived through those two things, and watching George Herbert Walker Bush, who managed the collapse of the Soviet Union, kicked Iraq out of Kuwait without getting stuck occupying the place for a decade, who actually had a fairly successful presidency. There was one problem, the tax increase, and he threw away a perfectly good presidency. People watched that. That's from 94 on is when we started to get ivory soap percentages of the modern Republican Party making a commitment not to raise taxes, because they said, I've seen this Lucy, Charlie Brown football thing with tax increases and spending cuts. I'm not doing that again. 2011, Obama comes to the Republicans, and the Republicans said, the Republicans had the House, and we took the House in 2010. We're not going to raise the debt ceiling, the $2.5 trillion that Obama needed to get him through the election, unless we cut spending $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years. You don't have to do it tomorrow, but over the next 10 years. And Obama kept saying, well, how about if we do part tax increase, part spending cuts? And Republicans said, all spending cuts, no tax increase. What about a little one? What about 3-to-1? What about 4-to-1? What about 10-to-1? No. Anyway, we ended up. I had several Republican congressmen who kept having impure thoughts about imaginary deals. And they'd say, Grover, but if they brought a pink unicorn, I'd be willing to raise taxes in return for a pink unicorn. There aren't any pink unicorns, and there aren't any budget cuts. So stop imagining what you'd trade for a pink unicorn. And so we passed on imagining pink unicorns, or budget cuts that were never going to happen, in return for a tax increase that was. And we got real budget cuts. That's the caps and now the sequester that took effect. And that's the fight. Now, all during that fight, you saw this argument about how come we can't have bipartisan compromise in Washington, D.C. like the old days, okay? People who talk to you wistfully about bipartisan compromise are telling you how very old they are. Because they're remembering back to when there would be an argument and they'd blow the whistle and everyone would go to their corner. Over here, the liberal Republicans would caucus with the liberal Democrats. And over here, the conservative Republicans and the conservative Democrats would caucus. Then they'd all come out and fight. And everything was a bipartisan argument because the two parties weren't divided on the central question of size of government or other issues. But again, over time, they did sort themselves out. And you could have, when Nixon was president, bipartisan compromise, because Nixon every day and every year would go, I'd like the government to get bigger. And Ted Kennedy, his nemesis from my home state of Massachusetts, would say, I want the government to get very much bigger. And they would compromise between bigger and very much bigger. So every year it'd get sort of bigger. And every year they'd head that way somewhat. And they could compromise between bigger and very much bigger. That's pretty easy to do. Here's bigger, here's very, and right in the middle there is a sweet spot. They had bipartisan and they had compromise because they were going in the same direction. Today, however, the Republicans have passed the Ryan Plan, which is a budget for the next 50 years. Right. Evidently, the guys are throwing you out. So you've got a situation today where the Republicans have passed the Ryan budget. Doesn't raise taxes, balances the budget over a decade, cuts spending about $6 trillion. We've switched to the T's now. $6 trillion over the next decade. And then brings the budget to balance and actually pays down the debt as you go out because it reforms the entitlements to where they become sustainable and it reforms many of the 185 welfare, means-tested welfare programs by block granting them the way Clinton did with aid to families with dependent children. Does the same thing with the other welfare programs that Clinton did with AFDC. And that reduces spending over time down to 16.5% of GDP from 22-23. And the D's want $1.5 trillion tax increase from where we are on top of Obama's $1 trillion of tax increase, which is baked into the cake for health care, and on top of the $600 billion that we got out of the fiscal cliff. Okay? So one party wants lower spending and lower taxes, and the other wants higher spending and higher taxes. Now, somebody wants to go west, somebody wants to go east. What would a compromise look like? These people who keep talking about compromise assume that this is 40 years ago and we've all agreed to go to generally bigger government. You know, it's just a question of how far and how fast. They've missed that there's now a disagreement about direction. And that's why the fights we have are partisan, whereas they were nonpartisan before, or bipartisan before, but now the two parties have sorted themselves out. All the interesting fights are partisan. And they're serious because they want to go in two different directions. So those are the ones that are taking you at the national level to have gridlock. Made available to people. I hope you got one. If you didn't on the way in, I hope you get one on the way out. This map should go on your refrigerator because it explains American politics for the next decade. The 25 red states have a Republican governor and a Republican House and Senate. So if the Republicans in the legislature and the governor get together, they can turn 25 states into Texas or Hong Kong as quickly as they want. In the states, we don't have conflict in terms of not being able to agree. We have confluence. They're moving in the same direction. In 13 states, California being one of those, blue states, Democrat governor, Democrat House, Democrat Senate. So in the 13 states, those states can turn themselves into California or Greece as quickly as they want to. They can just, if the D's agree, they can do it. There's nobody can stop them. In the red state, if the R's agree, they can move as quickly as they want in the opposite direction. This is where the action is for the next decade. And that's because as they redistricted themselves in the last couple of years, the red states redistricted themselves to maintain Republican majorities in their legislatures. The blue states redistricted themselves to maintain Democrat control through their state legislatures. So the legislatures, governors may come and go, but the legislatures in the red and the yellow states are going to be Republican, and in the green and blue states, the legislatures will be Democrat. And we'll see what works and what doesn't. And these states are doing dramatically interesting, different things, from education reform. Indiana just had the courts rule that the 500,000 school vouchers that 60% of the kids in that state have available, 500,000 of them, $5,000 scholarship voucher, a part of what the state was going to spend on your education, goes with you. And now the kid can take that to a private school, a public school, a charter school, the public school down the street, and you'll have true competition between providers for education. Louisiana has a similar project, about $5,000, also about 400,000 kids available. Arizona, 200,000 to 300,000 kids have education savings accounts there, which I think are even better than the vouchers because they're $5,500 scholarships for private school, public school, charter school, homeschool. And if you have a private school that costs less than $5,500, like $4,000, that $1,500 goes into your education savings account for high school or college later on. So right, the challenge right now is if who's going to charge less than $5,000 in Indiana for a private school, right? Because everybody's got an unbreakable $5,000 scholarship. So everybody's going to charge $5,000. I think the other states will move to the innovation there. The question of dealing with pension reform, which California is wrestling with and some of your states and local governments are wrestling with as well. In Wisconsin, they passed a law which stops organized labor, the public sector unions, from taking from a teacher who makes $50,000 a year, $1,000 out of their pay. They never see it. It's withheld by the local government. And the government, the new law in that state for the last 2 years now is, if you want to get $1,000 from a teacher who makes $50,000, you go ask them for it. We're not stealing it for you. You can go get it from them. About a third of the public sector union members in the state have chosen not to contribute to the public sector unions in that state, and a number of the unions are actually disappearing. But in Alabama, they used to take $3 every month from every Alabama Education Association work, or 100,000 of them. So it's $14 million every 4 years straight into politics, taken from every worker without their choice. They said, we're not doing that anymore. The school district, the town, the city, the county is not taking money from government workers and handing it to somebody else to play with. You want to ask them for political money, you can ask them for political money. You cannot have the government come and take it out of their hands. So taking a look at how these states, California, there are 165 million Americans in the red states, so more than half the country, 81 million Americans in blue states, a little more than a quarter of the country. So those are the two. So when we talk about the modern Republican Party, and I'll yield to questions on what you want to focus on in terms of what the Republican Party might do differently in the future. I've got my own list. But I would caution when people say, oh, the Republican Party disappeared off the map in November of 2012. 30 Republican governors, 20 Democratic governors, 25 states with complete Republican control, good for about a decade because of redistricting, not a one-off thing, and 13 states run by Democrats. Twice as many Americans, the majority of Americans, live in states run by Republicans. And at the national level, thanks to the marvels of redistricting, the House of Representatives, which is Republican now, will probably stay Republican for the decade. The Senate's up in 2 and 4 years, and the presidency's up in 4 years. So I'm actually, I think the Republican Party is well poised to do well electorally, but that also does depend on, I think, some reforms as we move forward in the future. But to set the stage as to where we are, I think some of the guys who announced the Republican Party disappeared in November missed something, and we can get into why I think Obama's first term lasted 2 years up until the Republicans took the House and started to say no, and his second term ended on the 2nd of January when he signed the fiscal cliff deal and made all of the Bush tax cuts, which had been temporary, and the AMT patch, which had been temporary, he made 85% of them permanent. He had a sword, which was every 2 years these tax cuts disappear. And if he'd let them lapse every 2 years or let them lapse every year, whenever he negotiated with Republicans on spending, like the sequester, he would say, well, if you insist on a budget cut, I will insist on not letting you keep as much of next year's lapsing tax increase. How big was the sword he once held and holds no longer? It was a $500 billion with a B tax increase on January 1st. Lasted a whole day. Remember, on January 1st, taxes went up $500 billion. Bush 2001 tax cut went away. 2003 tax cut went away. And the AMT patch, which was a huge piece of that, went away. 85% of it was restored for 98% of Americans. And now we go forward. And the president took his leverage and threw it away. He just walked away from it. So now when he goes into the sequester and says, how about not having the automatic sequester, not having the $1.2 billion in spending cuts? The Republicans looked at him and said, thank you, no. And he had no argument. He had no clout, no ability to argue, to force the Republicans to stop the spending cuts. And he could have had it. He did have it. He threw it away. He set it to the side. And so now there isn't anything that the Republicans need him to do that he'd be willing to do. So we'll just manage the sequester, manage the reduction in spending, wait for a different Senate, wait for a different president, and pass Ryan. But there aren't going to be any massive new spending programs, massive new taxes. There's what you can do through the executive orders, but not legislative progress for his agenda. So it's the first term lasted 2 years. This last one didn't get past the inaugural. And I to this day, I have interesting conversations with really smart Democrats who tell me I'm right, that they see that they had this leverage, they threw it away, and they don't know what they do now. It's a very interesting question. Questions, thoughts? Do I take them from here?
Sure.
Do you
have a seat.
You read. Oh, we sit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We can do this.
Thank you. So
As you see, I have many, many questions here. I've tried to kind of group them a little bit into themes, and obviously we can't cover all of them. But just start out, you know, in your remarks, you kind of did a good job of sort of parodying the Democratic position on things in general. But the sort of difficulty, it seems to me, is that those are kind of majority positions for the most part. I mean, people like their Social Security, they like their Medicare, they like their public schools. And if you look at the election results, if you look at all the polling, you know, the sort of no new taxes, you know, all taxes are bad. That's not really a majority view. So how do you kind of, you know, manage with a position which is essentially a minority position?
Well, for starters, I'd point out that the polling that Gallup and others do, would you like a larger government that did more things and cost more in taxes, or a smaller government that provided fewer services? They even use that phrase, which I think tilts things in their direction. Fewer services and lower taxes. You get 2-1, 3-2 majorities for less government that costs less and does less for you. Okay, I think you could have a government that costs less and we could pass on farm subsidies and we could pass on occupying countries we can't pronounce. And I'm not sure we'd notice the lack of service that we just lost. But no, on the big picture items, do you want a bigger government that costs more or a smaller government that costs less? Exhibit A, 25 states that elected House and Senate and governors arguing for that, and 13 states that went the other way. I would argue that you had both with Obama running. He did not run as a candidate who was going to do a massive expansion of government spending. You may have thought, Grover, don't you know the guy's hanging around him? Of course that's what he'll do. That's not what he put in the ads. He ran ads trashing McCain in 2008 because McCain was going to raise taxes. One of the bills he had would have raised taxes on health care issues. He ran a lot of anti-tax increase ads.
Okay, so you really think that the reason that Obama has been successful is because he has been dishonest about what his program is?
Well, in terms of if he believed, and I think there's a very interesting thing the Republicans have done in the Ryan plan. I'm not sure everybody quite understands what a dramatic shift that is. The Ryan budget actually walks through how to reform, doesn't deal with Social Security, because that takes 60 votes, any change in Social Security, but Medicare, Medicaid, and reforms them as exactly what Clinton did to means-tested programs with aid to families with dependent children, which is why it was funny to see Clinton attack it as a bad idea. It was his idea. It was a good idea. Reforming entitlements. Those are proposals that they've run for office with. I mean, all the Republicans voted for it in the House before the 2012 election. They just won an election having put it forward. If Obama had believed that Obamacare was going to be a popular thing if people understood it, he'd have written it down and put it on the web before the 2008 election. And that not only didn't do that, they didn't let the congressman read it before it was passed. I'm a strong advocate that no bill should be passed in the state or the federal level that hasn't been online for 7 days. So not just so the lobbyists can read it, which the lobbyists all read this stuff, not just so some of the congressmen can read it, but the American people can read it. Now, somebody, well, I'm not going to read it. No, you know, but there are a lot of people who will read it, and they'll put out their own distillations of it, and they'll shoot out to the people who are affected what would happen. I think that ought to be the culture we have, and the Republicans have done that with the Ryan plan. I think it's huge. If the D's believed that they would be advantaged by telegraphing to you what they would do if they won the next election, they would put it in writing. They, not I, they believe they will do better.
Okay, so
if
you,
it's not
so you
in
do
writing.
Believe that it was kind of an obfuscation that led to the Democratic victory?
My argument is that the Democrats must believe that or they'd have acted differently.
Okay. You talked about your map there and that the red states will stay red for 10 years because of redistricting. And I think a lot of people feel that the kind of partisan redistricting is fundamentally anti-democratic and that is in fact why the House is the way it is because of anti-democratic redistricting. In California, there's now nonpartisan redistricting, so it's not the case that Democratic states and Republican states do the same thing. So how do you respond to that that view that this kind of gerrymandering is really not the way we should run our government?
Well, for about 200 years, we had gerrymandering, and up until the last 15 years, the Democrats controlled the process in most states and never whined about it. And now,
but that's not the question, though.
No, but it is the question. It is the question. No. You can't change your position on this stuff and go, now there's a problem.
I'm just asking a question. Today,
yeah.
Do you think that gerrymandered redistricting is good public policy?
I would argue, well, gerrymandering was our friend Jerry from Massachusetts who was doing it back then. You have to take that question apart because the Voting Rights Act requires a gerrymandering on racial grounds. This was the liberals' idea. We're living with it. They extended the law 25 years. So why did the liberals do that, and why does it damage their electoral prospects? Talk to the liberal Democrats why they wrote that bill, why they did it, why they like it. Don't stick the Republicans with the Democrats' legislation, which, in fact, hurts the Democrats. But they did it. So on this, I would argue, take a look at these states. When I was talking about over the next decade, that it stays like this, partly people won elections, and also Illinois, the Democrats in Illinois gerrymandered it. I don't know who you think was running the California one, but it was run by Democrats and Democrat consultants, which is why they gave themselves the two-thirds majority that you have in California. You had to work at those districts to get it. I realize it was called nonpartisan. They called it that in New Jersey, too. And I think that's clever, but it was a clear partisan redistricting. Talk to any Republicans.
Republicans would say that, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't think most people think the redistricting was partisan in California.
Okay. Do you think your pension is fully funded?
Well, that's a different question.
People in
California
we'll get into
pensions in a second. But first, I should say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is conservative activist Grover Norquist, who's discussing taxes, politics, and his take on the state of America. You can also find the video Commonwealth Club programs online at 4TV. So if we can continue on a slightly different tack here,
sure.
Because there are many questions about this, which is that you have the kind of leave us alone philosophy, but the Republican Party, you know, over recent decades has been very interventionist on social issues, abortion, contraception, gay marriage, things like that. Do you think that the party should really steer fully away from those issues?
Look, I think that the party, the movement, should look at how to deal with some of those issues to minimize state power and to minimize state interference with how people run their lives. The example I gave earlier, which was a very frustrating one for Republicans when they said, well, the solution to the decline of morals and character in public schools is that there's no more, you can't talk about God in public schools, you ought to have prayer in public schools, that's what we ought to do. Well, that frightened people because they thought, well, my kids will be listening to other people's prayers. And it's concerning. Then you said, okay, well, then let's give everybody the choice of going to a charter school, a secular school, a Roman Catholic parochial school, a Jewish day school. Everybody should have whatever choice they want, homeschool. Well, all of a sudden, you just eliminated all of that conflict and you gave people more options. What were you responding to? You were responding to the person's real concerns, which was, I'm concerned about the moral atmosphere of the kid my school goes to. You don't have to run everybody else's. You just want some control over your own kid's education. Maybe you homeschool. Maybe you send them to parochial school. Maybe you send them to witch's school. Whatever you want, up to you. So I think that you need to look at those issues and decide how do you deal with them in a way that is most enhancing to liberty and articulates what you're trying to do correctly.
Would it be fair to say that you sort of reject the kind of Christian right agenda which says that people that government should kind of enforce a certain set of religious-based views around contraception, abortion, gay marriage in particular?
Well, on contraception, I think there's an easy question there. You say the federal government ought not to be taking money from people and spending it on that issue. People should handle their own situation. We shouldn't, if somebody finds it morally problematic, as Roman Catholics can, you shouldn't tax them and fund something that is problematic. And nobody's told you can't do anything, but we're not going to force you to fund it. So there are near, I mean, the same
and
thing.
And how about gay marriage?
Gay marriage is the interesting one where the federal government, okay, the Europeans screwed this up a long time ago when they got the state involved in marriage. Before that, it wasn't. And so what? How do you disentangle the state's interference in what people of faith see as a sacrament? But then the state stepped in and grabbed a hold of it and has been redescribing it for some time. I tend to think that I started to get into the federalism thing. I tend to think that you're going to see gay marriage, gun control, a number of issues be ones where the Tenth Amendment and federalism help answer some of these questions. Do you need a one-size-fits-all top-down effort, or do you have different states doing different things? And fears people have on gay marriage may evaporate when they look at New York do it for a while and they go, oh, that didn't do what I thought it would do. And you're seeing the same conversation now on marijuana prohibition. Some states, I mean, for some time have been having a little lighter hand on that. And I actually much prefer 50 states taking 50 different approaches on difficult questions, because then you can say what worked, and you can look around and see what's worked and see what doesn't work. And if there's a fear that's real, and you know, if you liberalize the marijuana laws in Colorado and everybody falls to pieces, you go, okay, you back up. And if you liberalize and that's not what happens and it's no worse or better than alcohol, which has its problems, you go, okay, well, it's not what we feared.
From a philosophical level, or on, you know, kind of leave me alone,
yeah,
philosophy, wouldn't that just kind of say, I mean, marijuana prohibition would be a classic case of, like, what's the philosophical justification for prohibition of that if your basic position is government should leave me alone?
I think that's the strength of the argument against prohibition. It was the argument against prohibition on liquor, and also when you have prohibition of liquor, it gave you organized crime. So there are costs to prohibition as well as cost to people abusing substances. I think we should be very good. There are not no costs to people abusing alcohol or drugs. There are costs, and it scares people. It worries people, understandably. How do you minimize those costs while maximizing human liberty? And so on one level, you can answer some questions philosophically. On the other, okay, we're here. How do you want to get to a more free and open society? I would like to have some of those conversations, not these he said, she said shouting matches in D.C., but let's look at the 50 states, see what works, and then you can point and say, we did this in Arizona, and nobody died, and things got better. And even better than that, nobody lost an election. See? Now, you should feel comfortable in your state thinking about doing the same thing. And you're not going to get politicians moving on reforms unless they feel secure that they're not sacrificing their entire political career on an experiment. And that's why some of these steps forward at the state level, I think, are extremely helpful. I'm for federalism. I don't like states' rights. States don't have rights. People have rights. States have powers, okay, over people. And states' rights means I can beat up everybody in Alabama I want to. No, that's not what we want. We want federalism where 50 states compete to provide the best government at the most reasonable price and then see whether people move from Indiana to Illinois or from Illinois to Indiana. And that gives you a real clue on how people feel. And just to get back to the redistricting, 30 governors, Republican, 20 governors Democrat. You can't redistrict states. So I don't mean to suggest that the Republican success at the state level was driven by redistricting. They won those races before redistricting. I'm just suggesting that after redistricting, if you were counting on taking it all back tomorrow, it's less likely.
There's another large set of questions which all essentially go to the question of what do you view as appropriate powers of government? In other words, what should the government do? I mean, nothing? I mean, should we have no government, kind of state of nature, Hobbesian, you know?
No.
Or
no.
Rousseauian, for that
yes.
matter.
You know? neither Rousseau or Hobbes. Neither Rousseau or Hobbes. Yeah, this is a fascinating one. And some liberal writer yelled at me in the Huffington Post and said I was an anarchist and a revolutionary because I wanted the government to be smaller. You know, I'm thinking, you know, if somebody, you know, mentions to a friend that they should lose weight, are they really telling him they should disappear from the face of the planet? No, he's saying you'd be better smaller. Not gone. Cancer doctors are not anti-cell. They're anti-cells that reproduce so quickly they hurt people. Okay? And I'm against government that becomes like a cancer cell, too big, and it hurts people instead of helping people. You want a reasonable government. I think the people who wrote the Constitution were paying attention and had learned a lot from history and suggested that there's some limits, and there's shorter than Leviticus, there are a list of things you cannot do these things. You cannot tell people what church to go to. Well, what if we had 2/3 vote? No, you can't, ever. In the back, you know, and there are a whole series of limitations on government, and then there's a list of things the government's allowed to do, and except for the post office, I think most of them were good ideas. So that was Ben Franklin. We really need to speak to him. We should have a limited government, and I always find it not you, but when folks on the left go, so you want no government? No, we want a government that's reasonably priced. Not terribly intrusive, that does the minimum amount of pushing people around while protecting people's rights. I mean, you want to have a government
so
that protects rights.
Let's go specific, sort of specifically from the top. So, you know, huge military.
Mm-hmm.
Yes or no?
Huge military, well, I would consider when the government is shrunk down to the size that I would find it appropriate, I think it'll probably still be huge in any sense of the word. Here, there's a very interesting thing that happened, and that is the sequester. The sequester, I'm answering your question not only on my behalf, but on behalf of the modern Republican Party, which I think is good. They don't always see things as quickly as I explain them to them. But in this case, it was pretty good. Obama agreed to the sequester as the fallback, where if we don't agree on something else, which he was hoping would be tax increases instead of spending cuts. If we don't agree to something else, we'll have the sequester. The sequester will be half from defense and half from some social spending, non-defense spending. But it was more heavy as a percentage on defense than on other things. So defense goes up, you know, like this instead of like this. You can't really see it. But it's there. I mean, it's not nothing. It's $500 billion over the next decade in less spending on the Pentagon. It is substantial. It is not nothing. And Obama believed that the Republicans, because he was watching CNN and saw the same three Republicans cycling through CNN, all announcing they were going to get the vapors if the defense budget was touched. And he thought that the modern Republican Party would do anything other than allow defense spending to fail to grow as rapidly as somebody was hoping that it would. And at the end of the day, what he didn't notice was it was the same three guys cycling through CNN's TV shows, McCain, Lindsey Graham, and somebody else. That's not a caucus, guys. It's not. The modern Republican Party recognizes that is defense is actually mentioned in the Constitution once or twice. It's a legitimate function of government. We've got to keep the Canadians on their side of the border.
To be a little more serious about this, do we need, you know, aircraft carrier fleets in Asia and the Middle East? And I mean, this is not a trivial question. I mean, there's huge sums spent on a global military presence. So Do you think that that is consistent with a vision of small government?
Look, we're a republic, not an empire. We do well to protect ourselves. I'm in favor of punching anyone who punches us back. I'm not in favor, once you've punched them after they punch you, of going and sitting on top of them and their families and their relatives for the next 10 years. I'm not sure that that makes your point or makes us safer. And so I think we need to both have a defense strategy and a defense capability, which says to anybody, don't throw punches at us, we will get you back, but doesn't go around sitting on top of people or trying to turn countries into Kansas that don't want to be Kansas.
Okay, so let's continuing sort of from the top on proper functions of government. So Social Security, mm-hmm. Medicare, you know, health care more broadly, does the government have a responsibility to make sure that people have access to health care?
Yeah, I think the first thing we have to do when we ask what should the government do about X is make a list of things the government is doing on those that give you the opposite result from what they claim they're trying to do.
Right, but I do want to just talk about appropriate functions for government.
Yeah, the government, it's not appropriate for the government to increase the price of your health care by mandating all sorts of benefits that you didn't ask for, you didn't want, and you'd rather contract for somebody with a different
Who don't have enough money to contract with anybody, should the government be providing health care for those people?
Back up. Why are some people poor and some people not poor? Does we start off with government programs which make it difficult to get jobs in the first place? Do we have government programs and tax increases that move jobs out of California into other states? You can't just sort of take the government, the things that they are, and say, well, what should the government do more of, given the problems we have? Make a list, understand, deconstruct, what's the government doing now that give you the problem you have? We have food prices are high, okay, and we have government programs to maintain high sugar prices and maintain high other prices, and ethanol, which is pricing corn out of international markets where there were riots in Mexico because of the price of corn there. The government's doing a lot of things to do damage. First, take all the shards of glass off the pizza before you ask anyone to eat it and before you offer to put more shards of glass on the pizza. So, now, on Social Security, pensions, I think we should move, starting with California, although you guys are probably going to be last, from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans so you don't end up with what's Stockton and other cities and the
state. That's already happened outside of the public sector.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, the private sector quickly moved much quicker on this. Yeah. However, Utah, 2 years ago, all new hires in Utah, government workers, state and local, cops, firemen, everybody, gets a 401k, 10 or 12% of your pay into a 401k. They're not accumulating any new unfunded liabilities. 14 years ago, they did this for state employees in Michigan. Okay, it's saving them in Michigan several billion dollars already. And that's not even local employees. That was just state. Louisiana has done a version of this. A lot of states are doing that. On Social Security, I would hope we'd move to what Chile and about 20 other countries have, which is you say, here's your FICA taxes, put in a 401k, you control it, not the politicians. Because when you send your money into Washington, they spend it the next week. They don't save it for you. You know, they're not holding on to it. They're not investing it in anything. They spent it. And if you're expecting anything back, it's because they're going to get it from your grandchildren in the future with higher taxes. So the government should be transparent in how it spends, and the government does not plan well for the future. And we're much better off if you're dealing with the government, if you're a government employee, here's your pay, here's your 401k contribution, and don't expect us to show up with more later and show up later and go, oops, we forgot about you.
Right. Unfortunately, individuals plan very poorly for the future also, it turns out.
A lot better than the government does.
I don't know. okay,
the
environment.
Private sector pensions in California are not falling apart. Your public sector pensions are. QED.
Environmental protection, it's a classic kind of collective good. You know, you can't really act individually to have cleaner air. So what should be the government's role there?
I think you want to work to make sure that stuff that's really dangerous doesn't show up in the air. This has been done through tort law in the past. It can be done through some regulation.
Through tort law? So
that's what you used to do. If somebody dropped stuff in the water upstream from you, you sued them.
Even though that's good for all those Democratic trial lawyers?
Yeah, well, if that's all they're suing on, you're probably pretty good. People tend not to drop stuff in the water that way if they know they can get sued.
But in all seriousness, yes, I mean, California is a great case in point, right? Because California is by far the leader in environmental regulation, has been for many years, and people seem to like that. You know, they want the government to do things that will have cleaner air, cleaner water, all those good things.
Well, I think you take a look at what can be done, and there are challenges. This whole, we were told ethanol, that if you put ethanol in gasoline, it turns out it's not cleaner even on the basis of what they wanted it to, and it has all these secondary effects. Just because the government announces they're doing X doesn't mean X has happened. And that's true in the regulatory scheme, and it's true in tax and spending policy. I think we should just keep an eye on things and see if it works.
Okay. Well, and I think in California, the air is vastly cleaner than it used to be, for example. So
yeah, and the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how much did it cost? How much would have happened in other cases? And just keep an eye on how to maintain it without being overly abusive in situations.
Okay.
You guys have energy problems. You didn't get the pipelines that maybe somebody should have built, or refineries that maybe somebody should have built. Those are not without costs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On another tack, and there were several questions about this, has to do with the money for your group and this whole issue of kind of secret money in politics. And one of the issues I think it kind of raises for you is that tax cuts, you know, by definition, you know, benefit most the people who pay the most taxes, which is people who have the most money. So if those people can kind of secretly fund an anti-tax agenda, do you think that's a healthy dynamic?
Well, C4s, like the ACLU or Americans for Tax Reform, don't divulge donors. And the reason for that is for the same reason you don't want the government. I mean, we argue with the state on a regular basis. The ACLU does. I do. I had breakfast with the lady who runs the ACLU Washington office on Monday. Together we're fighting against the federal government can't read your mail without getting a warrant to do so. They can read your emails without getting a warrant. The Fourth Amendment has not kept up, and so we're working with the ACLU jointly on getting that fixed. I think we'll have that fixed this year. Watch for it. It's not a certainty. Some of the guys on the FBI like to be able to read people's emails. The American general in Afghanistan wished people didn't, but that was legal because it doesn't take a warrant in that case. So I think you need to protect people's political activity when the state power is that annoyed at people who would limit their power.
So you don't disclose your donors because you're afraid the government is going to come after you in some fashion?
What do you mean, in some fashion? I've had senators call when donors and threaten, and not in some fashion. Yeah,
threaten,
absolutely.
Threaten what?
Threaten going after people. This is
in what way?
Targeting particular groups, individuals. This is not. It is not my concern alone. And of course, the Supreme Court's been very clear for just that reason. This is, I think, a very important. Religious groups should not have to disclose donors. This is not a serious question. What's easy for ATR is we oppose any and all tax increases. Okay, who would support that? Well, people who don't want their taxes increased. Okay, and what would you know? And what were you worried about something or other? Active groups on the left that challenge state power and active groups that are conservative that challenge state power always have to be concerned about abuses of state power. During the Clinton years, I was on the commission, a congressionally created commission on restructuring the IRS, and one of the things we looked at was abuse of audits. And during the Clinton years, they audited all the groups on the right, not me, because I was on the commission studying it. And none of the groups on the left. I talked to my friends on the left. You guys getting on it? No. The groups on the right were. There were serious abuses, and this needs to be treated very seriously and not tolerated.
Okay, well, we're about ready to wrap up here. And just one last question, which is another that was asked many times here, which is that the position is comes across as an absolutist position. And absolutist positions are kind of difficult to deal with in a democracy that depends on conversation. So a summary of these kinds of questions was, you know, how does an absolutist position like that, you know, play in a system where we're trying to kind of work together to solve problems?
Well, the way to solve problems is to move towards what we're trying to get to is more liberty and a freer society and a more successful and prosperous society. Raising taxes does none of those things. So why would you wouldn't
well,
raise
that's
taxes?
That's one side of the argument, yeah.
Okay. Raising taxes does not make you freer, better off, or happier. And if you look at states, the states that raise taxes are doing more poorly than the states that don't. The states that have higher taxes are doing more poorly in job creation. And it's not, I mean, the idea that taxing rich people hurts rich people, yeah. But the people that get hurt are the guys who don't get jobs because taxes slow economic growth. And if we had an economic recovery from the bottom of the recession that we just had, the strength of the one from the bottom of the recession that Reagan got, we'd have 11 million Americans at work today. When you raise taxes, as Hoover and FDR did, and as Obama did, rather than reduce taxes and reduce regulations, as Reagan did, you do not get the growth. Again, 11 million Americans, by definition, poorer than they'd like to be because they're not working today, would have jobs today if we'd had a Reagan-style recovery instead of the Obama, Hoover, FDR recovery, which takes an awfully long time to get back out of where you were. So there's no question here. We've lived through this stuff. Higher taxes, slow economic growth compared to what you'd otherwise have, that's never a good idea. It's never a good idea.
Okay. Well, we're out of time
here.
The
other side absolutely wants to raise taxes all the time. So, you know, every time you talk to Obama, the Democrat, we have to raise taxes. Well, don't be so absolutist about it, sir. Why don't you compromise?
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Grover Norquist, founder of Americans for Tax Reform. Thank Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. I'm Jonathan Weber of Reuters News, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.